today I'm joined by Kathy Blasiancic, Head of U.S. Microservices, and Mike Moran from our partners at Control Risk, who is the Chief U.S. Analyst on the Control Risk front. My name is Greg Daco. I'm the Head of U.S. Macroeconomics, and today we have a very interesting and insightful webinar to share with you. We are in an environment that is and was highly unexpected. Our most likely scenario had assumed a Clinton presidency with a split Senate. We're still in this environment of a relatively split Senate, although the Republicans did maintain a slight edge, but they're short of the so-called filibuster-proof majority of 60 votes in the Senate, so they need support from the Democrats in order to pass major legislation. So in terms of the actual election, there will remain quite a bit of uncertainty when it comes to a number of policies, whether it's with regards to trade, with regards to fiscal policy, with regards to immigration. A lot of uncertainty will remain, and I think that is going to be the key word when we look at the U.S. economy going forward, is uncertainty. We had discussed this idea of ex ante and ex post uncertainty prior to the actual election, the idea being that the ex ante uncertainty as to who would win the presidency was quite elevated, but perhaps more importantly, the ex post uncertainty is much higher than in previous cycles for two main reasons. First, there is the question of whether a lot of policies that Mr. Trump has put forward are feasible and implementable. And second, the risk that we have a so-called trial and error presidency. I think that is a big risk under a Trump presidency, is that policies are tried and tested. If they work, they stick. If they don't work, then they're pulled back. And that, I think, is in large part, Kathy, what we've seen in financial markets this morning, where overnight we had futures down quite sharply. We had the dollar falling. We had volatility on the rise. We had the Mexican peso falling very sharply. And now we've actually seen this morning somewhat of a stabilization at relatively flat levels relative to before the election. So in a sense, I think everybody's on edge. There's a lot of uncertainty as to what policies will be put in place.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing. And right now you're in a wait and see mode. I think that's how investors are looking at this. Obviously, it was a shock. As the polls came in last evening, U.S. time, that's when you started to see the markets reacted. Everything's accelerated in a sense. We thought we'd have a risk-off trade. Well, we did, but it didn't last for very long. And now people are assessing. The one thing I think I find kind of interesting is why the equity markets are back to where they were. I mean, they're down slightly. They're still down, but not as much. And is what's happening in the bond market. Yields have gone up quite a bit. And also the expectations, which we'll talk more about Fed rate hikes for December, hasn't changed much. So we've got bond yields actually higher. They broke through. We're up over 1.9% on the 10-year Treasury yield. And part of that's the expectation, perhaps, that we do get a loosening of fiscal policy. Again, we'll talk more about that and what the potential is for that. But that's what you're seeing in the bond market. Right now for the Fed, they're still pricing in high odds, almost 80% that they'll tighten in December. Again, we'll come back to that later, but.
Mike, what do you think about the general policy environment when it comes to this uncertainty? We've been talking about the market reaction, which was initially quite severely adverse, and now things seem to have stabilized and markets are on edge in a sense. What do you think that means in terms of policy?
Well, obviously, as you probably discussed, this is a correction from the, anticipation of a Clinton victory earlier. So markets do what markets do, in a historic sense, what happens is there is a reaction and then there's a kind of return to normal. So what we're looking at more is the kind of political landscape that Trump will enter. First in the lame duck period, because his victory does change what we believe would have happened in the lame duck period. Specifically, had Clinton won, we do believe that Obama and Congress might have gotten the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, Free Trade Accord, pushed through before Clinton took office. That's off the table now. The Congress that's just been elected, when it takes office on the 20th of January, is not going to want to face Donald Trump having just passed a free trade accord. They've got enough fences to mend. The other issue, I think, is what we're going to see is that you're going to have a kind of, very serious, pressure on Trump from his constituency to start doing some of the things he has said he's going to do, particularly on free trade and in trade policy. He's been quite stridently critical of China, of Mexico, and other low-wage manufacturing countries. And what we believe is rather than do some kind of the kind of drastic things like pulling out of NAFTA, what he might do is use the threat of pulling out to get people back to the table and try to change the terms of trade. So with somebody like China, where there is no bilateral investment treaty, those talks are dead, by the way, there's also the ability to go through the WTO to do a kind of processed shot across the bow, and then if he doesn't get his way, move toward what he's been talking about, this 45% tariff on anything coming in from China, 35% on Mexico. So the other issue for him really is that he's going to have a heck of a time getting things through Congress, even though the Republicans held on to both houses of Congress. I think the party remains deeply divided on major issues. Trump was a real break from Republican orthodoxy, remember, on many of the things, including free trade, but also on some of the fiscal policies he put forward. And I think you're going to see some real fights on the Republican side. And you have to remember the Democrats, even though they didn't take the Senate, still have a large enough minority to use parliamentary maneuvers to block major legislation. So there's going to be some incrementalism there. And then finally, I think what you're going to see is that in foreign policy, one place where he can act somewhat unilaterally as a president, he's going to take steps to renew, look at the Iran Accord, for instance, that was signed, to pressure NATO allies to do things like put spending on defense up higher, Asian allies to do somewhat the same. So we're going to be in a position where foreign policy, if Donald Trump does not feel he can make some of his promises happen through Congress, is going to be the shelter he finds, and he's going to be able to push forward with things like stepping up U.S. troops in the fight against ISIS and other things where the president has kind of unilateral power.
Thanks, Mike. And I think one of the other important elements in terms of policymaking is the composition in Congress. I think you touched upon a couple of these. We have still what is a fairly split Senate in particular, and I think there's going to be that need and desire to have bilateral agreements if anything on the fiscal front at least is to be passed.
Right.
So I think that's quite important to me to highlight, and the fact that in general Congress will maintain this general aversion to higher deficits, a preference for lower taxes and spending restraint, except probably on the military front, which you just highlighted. One of the elements you highlight here is Obamacare. Could you share your views maybe a little bit more on that?
Yeah, I think it's clearly been a touch point for Republican campaigns across the country. Some of the elements of Obamacare remain quite popular, but as a program, it has run into serious problems in terms of public relations. Actually, repealing it is a very difficult proposition. Trump has been very careful on the campaign trail to talk about replacing it with something. We haven't seen that something yet. And, in some ways, he's in a similar position that Obama was in 2008. He's talked a good game, and now it's like, okay, what is that something? Obama's answer was to kick the ball to Congress and let them figure it out. I would imagine there's a long way, a long, hard kind of slog between the day he inaugurates and the day he really tackles Obamacare. Rhetorically, of course, he'll rail against it, but the Democrats will dig their heels in, and I think you'll see a long period of hearings on how to fix various aspects of it rather than a complete, rescinding of it.
Okay, and I think one of the elements that you had highlighted with us previously, and I think that is very important to understand, is this difference between, on one hand, what unilateral power a president has, and on the other hand,
where he needs to negotiate with Congress and with, in particular, I think, to some extent, his own constituents.
That's right. And so what I've tried to do here is lay out some of this. I'm certainly not going to read through it. But this, what I try to do in this deck is give a sense of where the president really does have some unilateral powers. One of the ironies here, of course, is that for the last 8 years, or really more the 6 years since Obama lost his majorities in Congress, he's been taking unilateral actions to expand regulatory powers in the environment, energy sectors, and to some extent in financial services. Those powers were considered unconstitutional by many Republicans and challenged in court. Donald Trump now has those powers as of January 20th. He will certainly reverse many of these things, along with some of the methane gas emissions rules and some of the clean air and clean water rules that were aimed at the coal industry and the fracking industry. But he may also choose to, you know, exercise this power himself in some ways. So these tend to be incremental agency led rules that involve very specific aspects of the economy, but they can add up to serious costs and serious regulatory risks for companies in various sectors.
And I think the other important element with regards to future policies and rulings is the Supreme Court, right? That's currently split 4-4.
Right.
So that's what are your thoughts?
So, you know, the big one of the concerns was it should Clinton have won is that the Republicans might have tried to block, as they have for Obama, her ability to even hold hearings on a nominee for the Supreme Court. That's now off the table. With the Republicans holding both houses of Congress, they should be able to hold hearings. The type of justice that will be put forward, one would think, is going to reaffirm the beliefs of the Republican Party generally, but more specifically, the beliefs that Donald Trump has put forward. And defend his ability to get things done in somewhat of a unilateral way. I actually think they may question some of these justices about this issue of executive powers. It's been a real hot button for Congress because, of course, that's a shift of power from the legislative to the executive branch that they're very unhappy with. Donald Trump, of course, is now sitting in that chair. He may have a very different view of this and may like a justice who takes a little bit more, excuse the term, liberal view of how the executive should wield power.
Okay.
I just have one question for you. In terms of nominations, Supreme Court, and also I'm thinking about the Federal Reserve, there's two open spots in the FOMC. With Senate, they obviously have a simple majority. Is that all they need to confirm these appointees, or is there like some filibuster activity where Democrats could slow the process or stop it?
There is actually a requirement that you get 60 votes to actually convene the hearing. Democrats had already been scheming to change that because they were worried that even if they won the Senate, they wouldn't have those 60 votes. But they can, if you are in the majority, you can always change that rule. It's a procedural vote. And I think you're likely to see those type of hurdles cleared one way or another so that hearings do happen with both chambers of the Congress in Republican hands.
Thanks, Mike. I think one of the important elements that we have to highlight when it comes to the outlook under a Trump presidency is the economic environment. And we had done in the run-up to these elections a number of simulations looking at various scenarios. Our status quo here was our October baseline, where we were essentially agnostic as to what type of policy environment we would have. And here what I listed is the, on the upside, the Clinton unrestrained scenario where she managed or she would have managed to pass all of her policy proposals. And on the downside, what we had called the Trump adverse, and that would be an environment in which Trump would manage to push forward with his very protectionist stance, imposing trade tariffs on Mexico and China, our biggest trading partners, with retaliation from other countries, and even further trade protectionist measures against some of our other trading partners. And overall, we would enter an environment of reduced trade flows, increased inflationary pressures because of that. At the same time, we had assumed in this adverse scenario, which is, I think, an extreme on the downside, an environment in which, yes, Mr. Trump would be able to pass some tax cuts, much less than he initially proposed or subsequently proposed a $4 trillion worth of tax cuts, but that Congress, in negotiating with him, would require there to be substantial spending cuts, spending restraint
that would hurt the economy more than the tax cuts would boost the economy, because the tax cuts are oriented more towards the high-income earners. I think these are good views as to what the potential outcomes would have been. I think the reality is likely to be a bit more boring, but boring is not necessarily bad, because in a sense, what we have in a more moderate Trump scenario is one where there is much less of a negative initial impact on the economy. And let me explain that. If you take a look at confidence, and I think we're going to be talking about confidence for the next 4 years, but business confidence, consumer confidence, investors seem to have taken this announcement initially negatively in overnight, but now more positively or more neutrally, in a sense, relative to pre-election. And given the uncertainty about what policies could be put in place, there is that relatively modest negative, initial negative confidence shock, much less so if you want to take a comparison to the Brexit earlier this year. In terms of fiscal policy, what we think is likely is that we'll have a negotiated package in which essentially you have less of a fiscal drag than we had initially assumed because of the way the package is negotiated. In a sense, you have reduced taxes, still leaning towards the high income earner, so less bang for your buck in terms of taxes, but financed through a one-time tax on the foreign earnings that have been previously untaxed. That's something that Trump had put forward, taxing them at 10% instead of the usual 35% that is the corporate tax rate. That would generate some revenues. On top of that, you could, over a 10-year period, have restraint on the spending front to have a plan that is modestly expansionary on the fiscal front, but that spending restraint happens later, and that's what you're seeing in this purple line, is that the restraint happens at a later stage. And the trade stance is protectionist, but perhaps not as protectionist as we listed, because essentially there's a realization that imposing tariffs on a broad basis across an entire country is going to hurt you. And the gradual realization that perhaps you should have a more targeted approach to certain specific sectors and very cautious as to who you implement or threat other countries with implementing these protectionist measures mean that you're not getting as much of a negative impact on the U.S. economy. So this is just a side-by-side of what had been initially proposed. You see very large tax cuts. I think those are likely to be dialed back quite substantially under a Trump presidency. Spending restraints, but I think some of the offsets instead of spending cuts may actually be through this repatriation of profits and a one-time tax. I think there is also the potential for a modest infrastructure plan in Congress. And so we could potentially, in the latter part of 2017, see a modest stimulus on the infrastructure front if there is to be an agreement. And again, trade and immigration. Immigration is something we haven't really explored that strongly, but the short of it is that if you have an anti-immigration stance, over time, this tends to weigh on your labor force. It tends to create an older labor force because the population in the U.S. is aging, and it tends to create less of a boost from demographics onto the U.S. economy, something that is needed at the current time because, as some of you may know, we have lowered our estimate of potential output to only 1.5. But if you further weigh on the demographic lever here, that weighs further on the immigration profile. On minimum wage, I don't think anything concrete passes in the next administration. So just as a summary of what we've assumed and what we will be putting into our November baseline forecast, a more protectionist stance vis-a-vis particular China and Mexico, but not as protectionist as the 35 and 45%, and not as protectionist, I would argue, as our initial moderate Trump scenario of 10 and 15%. I think we're going to have threats. We're going to have some protectionist measures and regulations that are put in place that do restrain trade flows and do lead to inflationary pressures, but not as much as we had initially anticipated. I think importantly, we're going to see much less tax cuts because we still have a Congress that's generally adverse to deficits, still generally adverse to increasing the deficit, but still has some openness to generating somewhat of a stimulus environment for the economy, taxes on foreign earnings, reduced government spending in the latter part of the decade. But with accounting measures and a full 10 years to play with, you can have a little bit of additional infrastructure spending in the near term. Deportation of illegal immigrants, rate of 600,000 a year, I think that's quite high. That's about 1.5 times the max that was reached under President Obama. And there are difficulties as to the implementation of that, but that is a risk. And I think it's important to note that there could be a negative confidence shock on consumers and businesses once we start to see the light, in a sense, the true color of what policies are put in place. There is tremendous uncertainty right now, which means people tend to stay on the sideline. In particular, businesses tend to stay on the sideline. So what do we expect for next year in short? Growth, probably just shy of 2%. That's an improvement from this year, but not as good as we could have seen, maybe 2.1, 2.2, under a more stimulative environment with a Clinton presidency. Consumer spending and business investment, still that dichotomy between, on one side, consumers that are ready and willing to spend because they're seeing solid income growth that's supported by strong employment growth, and wages are starting to pick up, and that's supportive of income. But all in all, the trade-off between wages and employment is expected to not necessarily be a one-for-one. As the labor market matures, we're going to see less employment growth, but somewhat firmer wage growth, and income growth as a result is going to be a little bit more reduced than we've seen over the past 12 months. Businesses, very much cautious, and I think this Trump environment is going to weigh a lot on business investment, and I think that is one of the areas where the downside risks are the clearest. It's that business investment figure of 2% growth after a 0.5, 0.6 contraction this year. I think that is one of the areas where you could see a lot of downside risk. When it comes to the overall duration of the Trump presidency, I think the right-hand side of this chart on the left side, with economic policy uncertainty being very elevated, is likely to move higher. I think we're not going to be in an environment in which uncertainty dissipates as much as it would have under a Clinton presidency, again, because of that ex post uncertainty being unusually high. In terms of the longer term forecasts and assumptions, there is going to be some downside to growth from increased protectionism. There is going to be a potential for a negative drag from spending in the latter part of his presidency if he does manage to negotiate this agreement of lower taxes with spending restraint at a later period. So that's something to pay attention to in the latter part of his presidency. Are there upside and downside risks for this forecast? I think yes. And I think more and more over the next few months, you're going to hear us talk and emphasize those risks, both on the upside but also on the downside. On the upside, if there is the possibility in Congress, in negotiations with the Democrats, to pass a tax cut that is broader in the sense that it's not 40% for the top 1% of income earners and 20% for the top 0.1% of income earners, but somewhat broader, if there is the potential to finance that through a corporate tax reform, potentially that is something that could be favorable. If there is the potential for increased infrastructure investment even beyond what we've assumed in the baseline, and if there is reduced policy uncertainty, and this is a big if, then potentially we could have a more favorable growth environment. Of course, major downside risk if there is political gridlock, if there is a slow process of appointments in terms of filling in the different cabinet positions. We have a government shutdown looming at the end of the lame duck session in December. We have a debt ceiling crisis that could be possible in March. We need to raise the debt ceiling by March, although accounting measures might push that forward. And general policy uncertainty is negative for businesses. I always say this. businesses would rather know what's going to happen tomorrow, even if it's not favorable, than not know what's going to happen tomorrow. So that is a big risk, businesses staying on the sidelines even more so than they have been so far. I think that's a big, big risk. Kathy, I'll pass it on to you in terms of the market and Fed implications. But I'm always reminded of this this thing that panic is not an investment strategy, and maybe that's what we're seeing today.
Yeah, well, the markets, it's interesting, had a spasm of panic overnight, as maybe many of us did, but have settled down. And as I said earlier, we had been expecting a global risk-off trade. We didn't think it would be all that long a duration, but we were sort of surprised that it turned out to be just hours. It was very accelerated. Right now, I think the market is reflecting a lot of what you and Mike said, is you're in this wait-and-see mode of trying to assess, okay, what is it that Trump is actually going to propose as president, and what can he feasibly actually get through Congress? Because even though GOP retained control of the Senate and House, obviously there's wide difference of opinion on what the appropriate policy should be. But what's interesting, you know, just quickly on this chart, as I said, it kind of speaks to the idea that as the polls were narrowing and they look like it could start to favor a possible Trump win, we would see equity markets, you know, sell off quite sharply. And again, that happened, but we've settled in. So I think we're kind of in that wait and see period. You laid out, you know, Greg, what our views are in terms of growth and the risks around that. What I thought I would just show a little bit is some comparison what we had thought would be, you know, the Clinton win, and hers would also be negotiated because neither Trump or Clinton would actually be able to get their full policy proposals through. But, you know, contrast that with what we think will happen now under Trump. And the reason it's kind of good to do that because markets are forward-looking and they're based on expectations. So I think up until, you know, late last night, the markets have been generally the expectation swung that we're going to have Clinton. So even though the markets settled down, I think over time, and especially if his policies, even if watered down greatly, are still on the whole negative because you've got increased protectionism on the trade front. We're going to reduce labor supplies by, you know, tightening up and on the immigration issues. And as you said, the risk is what happens with businesses. Maybe consumer confidence doesn't falter all that much because a large swath of, obviously, America actually voted for Trump, so maybe confidence is not shaken. Actually, maybe it kind of stays the same or it's emboldened. But businesses are key. And I think how he handles that, how Trump as a president handles that, and how Congress, what they try to convey, is going to be very important for the markets, but also equally for businesses. And if you look here, even with Trump's views and policies being slightly negative for the economy, we have the stock market down about 5% or so over the next year. So, again, relative to where we stand now. And it is weaker versus Trump, Clinton, because we thought Clinton's policy would be more pro-growth at the end of the day. But nevertheless, it's because of the moderate scenario, because he's reined in by Congress, it's not a disaster. It's not a disaster for investors. I think that's what we're seeing again in the markets here. What I find interesting, though, is looking at the bond market reaction. Bond yields have actually moved higher. We're at, you know, over 1.9% on the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield, previously about 1.8, 1.85. You know, we thought if you had the risk-off trade, you'd get this flight to safety into bonds. And again, it was just at the end of the day, markets are assessing, waiting to see, but they're also pricing in the expectation that there is going to be some fiscal stimulus under Trump, and then whether it's lower taxes or increased infrastructure spending. I think a lot of that's going to come down to how Paul Ryan and other GOP members of Congress feel and how they stand on the budget neutral issues. As previously, if there were tax cuts, they'd have to be offset by spending cuts. It remains to be seen how that works. Now, maybe the quid pro quo is you do the corporate tax reform in the sense where you get the repatriated earnings from abroad, that gives you maybe $200 billion, maybe that pays for a modest tax cut, and maybe you backload the spending cuts and you get a little bit of infrastructure spending. But I think it's worth watching to see. And then in terms of gauging, I think ultimately, though, the pressure would be if we see slower growth, particularly in, you know, probably developing the end of 2018, that bond yields could actually ease a bit. It's going to depend on growth. It's going to depend on inflation. And at the end of the day, also how the Federal Reserve Act reacts to this. I think right now, in the very near term, the Federal Reserve is probably locked into this December rate hike. There's no reason to think, you know, policy's not, we're not going to have any new policies. Trump is not going to be inaugurated until, you know, January 20th or so. The Federal Reserve have no idea of what potential changes could ensue on fiscal policy front or trade or immigration. And so if they're looking at current economic conditions and inflation, and they've indicated that they think it's the right time to raise interest rates, seems to me the market's right in assuming that's going to play out. Right now, Fed Funds Futures is pricing in nearly an 80% probability of a December rate. I think that's right. Overnight, it did dip 50%, but again, that was that very quick knee-jerk reaction. I think the caveat to keep in mind is for the Fed is for December in the very near term is the markets need to continue to be orderly. We can have the equity markets trade lower to a degree, but we can't have a disorderly financial market like we saw earlier this year when there was concerns about the Chinese renminbi. If you had that, that would sideline the Fed, but absent that and absent any dramatic slowdown in the economic data or plummet in business spending, I think we're good for Fed rate hike. Then the interesting question is what happens next year. Now, as many of you may know, we have in our baseline forecast previously just one Fed rate hike for next year. Growth next year, is, as you said, Greg, is only going to be modestly slower. So you could make the case that the Fed should go ahead and still do one rate hike. However, if they start to learn what the policies could be, and they won't be enacted till the end of 2017 at the earliest, but if they get a sense that there's going to be adverse policies that impact the economy, it could force the Fed actually to be on hold for all next year. So that's something we're going to be watching and assessing as we get some more information. In terms of the dollar, you know, I think, again, it's very similar to what we've seen in the equity market. At first, there, you know, some weakness in the dollar, and when we've recovered there as well. And I think for the next year or so, probably not much change in the outlook for the dollar when you compare what a Trump win means versus what a Clinton win would have ensued. So, but over time, again, if we're right that on the whole there's negative adverse economic policies that are adopted, that also should be moderately negative for the U.S. dollar. And, of course, that doesn't take into account what's happening with the Mexican peso and possibly what could happen to other trading partners' currencies. That could be more of a bilateral situation. And then market-sensitive issues. And what does the next president, you know, have on his plate? Well, even before we get to that, we should talk about the lame duck session. We still need additional funding for the government by the end of this year to keep the government running and to avoid a shutdown. I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to have any stalemate or the government shut down. Probably they do temporary continuing resolutions to take us into 2017. But again, that is something that Obama and the current Congress have to deal with and hash out. We do have the debt ceiling. That was suspended, the debt ceiling, back in 2015. That is going to be reenacted in March. What it means is that the debt ceiling limit has to be raised in order for the government to borrow and issue T-bills and notes and bonds in the market. Typical accounting maneuvers the Treasury puts in place probably gives them breathing room to the middle of summer or so. But again, that could be an interesting development, although with the GOP retaining the House and Senate, it may be a little easier to raise the debt ceiling. But we'll see how, again, some of the more ardent anti- or austerity fiscal members of Congress will deal with that. And then we've gotten a lot of questions about the Federal Reserve. So obviously Trump and others, but particularly Donald Trump, has been very critical of the Federal Reserve and their efforts. The question would be, would Chair Janet Yellen remain on as the head of the FOMC? And I think the answer is yes. Her term doesn't actually expire until February 2018. Even if she gets a lot of heat from Trump, which is likely, our view is that she probably will stay on as a Fed chairman. Resigning could actually send the worst message, and that the Fed is becoming influenced by political rhetoric, and that's something they wouldn't want to do. Plus, I think Janet Yellen wants to stay and oversee this still very difficult transition in trying to get interest rates higher, and of course the challenges with whatever new policy could be on the horizon. There are two vacant seats, so when I asked you, Mike, on the FOMC, they're operating two governors down. We'd like to see the governors filled. I guess it's more likely we'll get that filled now, but obviously will be governors that will be of a Republican persuasion.
That's right.
And just a last comment here before we open it up for Q&A. I think it's also important to keep in mind that before the election results, we actually had seen bond yields, even globally, rising. Some of that was due, or a lot of it we thought was due to increasing inflation expectations. If you look at the TIPS market, which is the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities market, you can look at the difference between that and nominal yields and back out that inflation expectations have been rising. We think that's a bit overdone, or actually very overdone, because we think a lot of the increase in inflation we're seeing is the fact that oil prices are no longer declining and have stabilized, so that's pushing up inflation. Beyond that, we don't see a lot of inflationary pressure, certainly with our kind of continued modest or moderate growth outlook. But it's just important to keep in mind that's part of what's going on. So the market's pricing in a little more inflation, and on top of that, trying to figure out what the fiscal stance it can be and how the Fed's going to react. And here you could just see our expectations for Fed funds and the 10-year note and then the spread, which is the difference between the 10-year Treasury note yield and the Fed funds rate. Typically, as the Fed's tightening, the yield curve narrows, meaning short-term rates rise faster than long-term rates. Right now, though, what we're seeing is a steepening of the curve. And again, that's twofold. One, it's being led initially by inflation, but also this idea that maybe Congress is going to start to loosen the reins on austerity. So I think that's going to be an interesting dynamic that's going to play out for a while here in the bond market. And I guess just, Mike, in your view, do you think Paul Ryan, before we get to others' questions, do you think Paul Ryan and others are going to start to back off from some of their tough fiscal stance?
Well, you know, the challenge has not really been what they believe themselves, rather the ability to, you know, use the whip and keep the Republican caucus together. And the Tea Party faction of the Republican Party that grew out of the 2010 election has shown itself quite good at the kind of parliamentary blocking tactics that you need to hold business completely hostage to certain, you know, principles that they're standing on the deficit. Ted Cruz, of course, in the Senate, is that person on steroids, so to speak. He's a former clerk for a Supreme Court justice and certainly knows the game. So he has repeatedly been shown that he can do this, either using a filibuster or coalitions with other senators to stop business and to force things into budgets or out of budgets as they see fit.
Interesting.
We've started receiving a few questions through our email, so if you have any questions, feel free to send them at events@oxfordeconomics.com. We've already gotten quite a few questions. Some of them we've already answered, but maybe it's worth re-highlighting some of them. We had a couple questions on the Fed and markets. The question is, what happens to Chair Yellen? Her term ends in early 2018. What happens afterwards? You answered that, but maybe a repetition of that, the answer. And markets down sharply, futures overnight now have rebounded. How can that be interpreted?
Yeah, so let me start with Yellen. Yeah, so I think she's, you know, safe and she's there until her term expires in February 2018. Thereafter, it's an open question. Obviously, Trump will have the ability to nominate someone to replace her, and the Senate has to confirm that. So it's good likelihood that she won't be there after that. It's not clear even under a Clinton win, frankly, if she would have decided to stay. It's unclear. But yeah, then after that, the markets will start to try to price in and think about who the replacements are. I think it's a bit early now to say, but certainly, again, it's going to be someone of a Republican leaning. That's clear. It's just not clear at the top of the tip of my tongue who that could be. In terms of the second question was in terms of markets moving. Yeah, so, you know, I think this. Two surprises, I would say. You know, one surprise is just how quickly the markets have priced in this risk-off trade and then kind of eased and backed off. It's much quicker than what we saw with Brexit, and it's frankly much quicker than I would have suspected, just given what's at stake and just looking at the poll numbers. Is that one chart I showed you? But I think the markets have come to the realization that. You know, two things. One, it's not clear what Trump actually would try to get through as president. There's a difference between his political rhetoric when he's running and then what actually he'll try to push through. The other thing is he doesn't have, even though he's got a Republican-dominated Congress, he doesn't have the green light to do whatever he wants. There's going to be lots of negotiation, lots of resistance to his policies. So I think right now the market's waiting and seeing, and again, there's some increased, I think, likelihood being priced in both the bond and the equity market that maybe at the end of the day we're going to get more stimulus under Trump than we would have under Clinton. And that remains to be seen how that plays out.
Thanks, Kathy. We have many more questions coming in. Mike, one question for you. What's the risk from a regulatory perspective for businesses?
So there's some upside for business in this. The simple answer is that many of the, you know, regulatory actions that were done by executive order under Obama, a kind of an end run around a Congress that wouldn't play ball with him, will now be reversed, and that's not insignificant. So oil and gas, mining, particularly the coal industry, which has been, you know, really feeling the pinch of new rules about methane gas emissions, a whole raft of rules that the Obama administration's EPA have promulgated that would require states to draw up very complicated emissions reduction, protocols for the next 5 to 10 years. These things are, if, at the very least, on hold and in question, but possibly many of them just swept away at the stroke of a pen by Donald Trump. So that will be welcome news for anybody from frackers to you midstream players in oil and gas to miners and also those who have major factories who have been subject to emissions, penalties under state rules in some parts of the country.
That's quite interesting because we have another question as to the outlook for commodities forecast and whether we could see renewed deflationary winds from a downside risk to oil. That environment of less regulation bodes for increased production. We're in a market, especially on the oil front, where we have excess supply. We started to see over the last few months some rebalancing of this excess supply, but overall there is still general downward pressure or at least some lid in terms of oil prices. Do you think, Kathy, there is a risk of renewed deflationary winds from abroad, or are we actually in the opposite environment with capacity being cut down in China and import prices through higher Chinese prices coming back up more strongly?
A very interesting question. So, you know, just picking up the last part you talked about, so what we saw in China is their producer price index turned positive for the first time since 2012, and a lot of that was because of coal prices and other commodities rising. It wasn't just oil, and it's because they've cut back on production. There's still excess capacity, but if they have the ability to reduce production, That certainly helps a bit on the supply side. I think the regulation question is very interesting. Do we see an increase in production? I guess the question is how much regulation was holding back production in the U.S. I'm not sure I know that exactly, but we can get back on that. But I think it's a reasonable question.
The other question or a set of questions, I'm grouping them because we have a lot of questions coming in. But the question is essentially, what are the sectors that are likely to be most impacted by this result in terms of the election? I would say the sectors that are likely to be the most impacted are likely to be the trade-intensive sectors, the ones that are the most exposed to the international, for two reasons, because of the risk of heightened protectionist measures, actually potentially three reasons. The risk of a strengthening U.S. dollar as a possibility if we continue to get this divergence between the Fed still maintaining a relatively tight or tighter than the rest of the world, at least, sorry, tighter than the rest of the world stands, and potentially the risk of a pullback on the global growth front with countries being more cautious in this more protectionist environment for the U.S. Manufacturing, transport services, agriculture storages, those are all sectors that are quite sensitive to this environment and where I would potentially see more of a downside risk under Trump. The auto sector is also very important. Trade a lot of autos or automotive goods in parts with Mexico, and if we are to indeed impose more tariffs vis-a-vis Mexico, that is also a sector that is at risk. The other sectors I would say are probably related to confidence domestically, consumer and businesses. So if you think of consumer goods or if you think of machinery, engineering, all those elements are susceptible to changes in terms of the policy environment.
Yeah, and let me just add a few things. I think, you know, looking at it conversely, I think there's probably a relief rally potential in the healthcare sector, especially pharmaceuticals and biotechs. Pharmaceuticals had sold off quite sharply under the prospect of Clinton winning and the increased regulation she could put there on prices or other things, maybe even banks, although Trump is not also very seen as maybe that friendly to Wall Street in his disposition. And I think just picking up on what you said on the trade front, I think you also have to be careful if we did have some protectionist measures and retaliation, that import costs would go up. So any companies or sectors here that rely on imports as intermediate goods would be hurt.
Yep. Another question we have coming in is whether this idea of taxing previously untaxed foreign profits has an effect on business investment. We mentioned the fact that government revenues could rise. I've found this very interesting study coming from researchers at Harvard University that looked at the Homeland Investment Act of 2004, which was essentially a one-time amnesty with the idea that increased capital flows back into the U.S. for businesses would then be spent by these businesses, and what they found was actually there was very little of that. Most of the additional funds were actually funneled back into the companies through share buybacks. This is something that we're all familiar with over the last few months and years, so that is very important to keep in mind, not necessarily a big boost to business investment to be expected from this.
And just to add to that, just a little perspective too, you know, we wrote about business investment and how it's, especially on a net basis when you take into consideration depreciation, has been quite low. That was happening and businesses have been holding back this whole entire, you know, expansion. So even before the election concerns and what could happen there, you know, regardless of tax policy, businesses don't see ROI, which is return on investment. Once they see goods and demand for goods and services rise, businesses will respond. But absent that, this kind of sluggish growth environment, it's going to take a bit more to get investment and businesses to loosen up their reins.
Yeah, that's true. And we could potentially get something similar to what we had this year, where we had a very, very slow and actually contractionary start to the year on the business investment front. And until we get more clarity next year as to what policies are actually implemented, then we don't get businesses that are more willing to spend. As you say, final demand is really the key here. If we have an environment of general low confidence or lower confidence,
then we're likely to have lower activity. An additional question, Kathy, for you. It's a dual question. The first is just to reiterate our call for the Fed in December, and then the second one is there are open governor positions on the FOMC board. What do you see happening? Brainerd, in particular, was thought to be potentially heading towards the Treasury. What are your general views on the FOMC composition in this new environment?
Yeah, good. So first, just on the Fed. So our call for now is that the Fed will tighten in December based on our economic and inflation forecast and the fact that there's nothing new that will change on the policy front between now and December, and there will be no indications of what's coming down in 2017 or 18. So nothing that the Fed could sink their teeth in to say, okay, there's going to be this big change in fiscal policy, so we need to offset it potentially by staying on hold. You know, that's not the case. They've indicated that they would tighten by year end, and unless something happens between now and then, and the only two things I could see between now and year end, or between the Fed meeting, sorry, which is on December 13th, is that somehow we get this renewed, unexpected, you know, turmoil in the financial markets. But I think what we've seen over the last, you know, 12 hours or so gives you some faith that the markets are not going to get too overly turbulent here. But of course, that did change. If that does change, that could put the Fed on hold. The other thing is if we just had a tremendous downturn in economic data, again, something we're not expecting. In terms of the composition, we will be doing a piece and looking at, you know, Fed governors and the voting presidents. I do think that would be very important next year. I'd like to see the two FOMC seats filled, and I think you're right, Brainerd probably stays put right now because she's not going to be, you know, nominated to Treasury, I don't think. And I guess, Mike, the politics of it, I would expect that we should get more ability to fill those governorships.
Yeah, I think there's a far less likely that you're going to find, and not, you know, nomination hearing, you know, obstructions. I think in those hearings it might get a little rough, but yeah. It's not the parliamentary blocking tactic that it would have been had it been a Republican Congress and a Democratic president.
All right, maybe one more question, and this is for all three of us, but. We focused a lot on the U.S. We've talked about trade protectionism. What is the general impact from a political standpoint and from an economic standpoint on the rest of the world in terms of global growth? Maybe we start with the politics of it, relationships with our longstanding partners, whether it's NATO or others. How do you view that unfolding, Mike?
The general sense we have, and you know, our folks based around the world have been chewing on this for quite a while now, is that one of the main impacts is going to be on the health of the relationship between the United States and China, which it's hard to pick a bilateral relationship that's more important in the world. And this goes beyond the trade. The fact that now trade and potentially tariffs become a regular source of friction means that it trickles down to the rest of the relationship, which has always been, you know, a rivalry. For different models of different views of the world and, you know, rising power in East Asia, et cetera. So this creates a bit more brittleness in that relationship. And for the sake of stability generally, not just in the Pacific, but generally in the planet, U.S. and China really, the less brittle the relationship is, really the better it is for stability everywhere.
Okay. And Kathy, maybe from a global standpoint, the general picture is that we've reduced growth slightly in our baseline for the U.S., but until we know with more certainty what the potential stance on the economic policies is, we will not necessarily have a big or major reason to revise down our global forecast.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it looks like, you know, what we are going to be assuming is you get a bit more loosening on the fiscal front. Lower taxes, a little bit more infrastructure spending, but the negative drag will be from the immigration actions of trying to deport people and that the impact there, and then, of course, trade. He is going to be pressed, I think Mike started off saying, by his constituents that put him in there to do something on trade. That was such a big part of his platform. So we have to expect something, even if it's just increased tension. But I think, you know, net, it's probably not, it's maybe not as bad as feared, because he's just not going to be able to get all of the policies. That's the main point that he has advocated. He's not going to get those through Congress.
And we're likely to see, if there is a downside risk to U.S. growth and to other countries, more stimulus coming from, say, the ECB, maybe delaying the tapering of quantitative easing from other partners, in the case of China, maybe further stimulus to try to offset some of the slower pace of growth in the United States. So more stimulus likely to come just as an offset to this somewhat weaker growth environment. With that, I'd like to cap it off. Thank you very much, Mike, Kathy. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.